Okay, dreamers, this is the second part of the two-part series on Dan and Betty Broderick. If you have not listened to part one, pause this now, listen to episode 100 first, and then come back to this so you can be caught up. In part one, we discussed the early years of Dan and Betty, their marriage, its deterioration, the introduction of the mistress into the mix, and the ugly divorce. Now we're going to get into the events that followed. As Betty continued to spiral into a state of uncontrolled fury, obsessing over vengeance against her ex-husband and his new bride. And as a reminder, this episode is out of the ordinary for the show, where we've decided to leave in some of the more explicit content. So don't listen to this one if young children are around. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Early on the morning of November 5th, 1989, Betty Broderick sat in her kitchen looking at two letters in a long procession of letters that she had been receiving from her ex-husband's various attorneys. I read one article that said the letters were taunting and belittling to Betty, all of them sent at Dan's behest, accusing Betty of being irresponsible, incapable, untrustworthy, wicked, and basically crazy. But I read another article that said the series of letters were all in regards to the divorce. The final two were threats of fines and jail time unless her vulgar voice messages did not cease. Betty would later say that those messages were born out of a frustration in not being able to talk to her children, who were living with Dan full time. But based on the things Betty has been known to say to and about her kids, I can't help but feel that she is using them as pawns in her irrational chess match with Dan. I do sympathize with the hurt Betty obviously felt when Dan walked out on their 16-year marriage for a younger woman. There's no denying that is something very difficult to cope with. But her fight was with Dan, and I think she should have and could have kept her children completely out of the crosshairs. And her phone calls never, ever stopped. And that's what the final letters were about on that morning of the 5th of November, 2 days before Betty's 42nd birthday. The letters stated that because she continued to show signs of a pathological obsession with Dan, she would continue to not be in the right frame of mind to fulfill the latest child custody obligations. That was the last straw for Betty. She was losing her visitation. So before dawn, Betty got dressed. Her boys were asleep in their room at her apartment. She tucked her .38 caliber into her purse, got into her car, and headed over to Dan and Linda's house. So what exactly was Betty going to do? Well, she would later claim that her intentions were to go over there and kill herself in front of Dan to, in her words, splash her brains all over his goddamn house. And how exactly was she going to do this? Well, she had acquired that gun several months earlier, around the time Dan and Linda announced that they were going to get married. She also needed a way to get into the home. And she went about that by stealing her eldest daughter's keys a couple months earlier. I believe her daughter was driving with her mom when she got back to her apartment. She realized that she had lost her keys. Her mom had driven her back to the house and they looked around for them. I believe she had even been warned by her dad to be careful with the keys, as she did have a set to his new house. Well, the keys weren't lost. Betty had taken them from her. All part of this supposed suicide plan, according to Betty. Betty arrived at Dan and Linda's home at approximately 5:30 that morning. When she arrived, she tried the front door, jiggled the key, but it would not unlock. So she went around back, and this time, when she turned the key, it opened. Betty quietly entered the house. She ascended the stairs. She entered the bedroom and took aim and fired 2 shots into Linda, one in the chest, one in the head, killing her instantly. Then she pointed the revolver at Dan, who had already begun the process of attempting to get out of bed to reach for the phone. She fired 3 more times. One bullet struck Dan in the chest, one hit the wall, and the other hit his nightstand. But I also read a conflicting report that said Dan rolled off the bed and one of the bullets struck him in the back. But either way, the gun was empty, and Dan did not die right away. And I have read that he lived for as much as 30 minutes after being shot. Betty next removed the phone from the wall jack and took it out of the bedroom so Dan would not be able to call for help. I'm not really sure how much or how little Betty and Dan spoke after she shot him, but she has said that the last thing he said to her before she fled the scene was, "Okay, you shot me. I'm dead." Dan lying there, his lungs punctured by at least 1, maybe 2 bullets, coughing, gagging, struggling to breathe, and he choked to death on his own blood. And the fact that Dan's life could have likely been saved if Betty had not taken the phone and he was able to call for help was going to be damaging to her case later on down the line. Daniel Broderick was 44 years old, and Linda Colquina Broderick was 28. And as for Betty, everything that had tormented her for years, the fighting over money, property, custody, spitting hate, insults and threats, the pain of rejection, it was over, finally. Following the shooting, Betty went to a payphone. Then she went to her daughter's apartment, got some of her affairs in order, found an attorney, and turned herself in the same day of the killings. Betty never denied killing Dan and Linda, but always maintained that she went over there with the gun because he refused to listen to her, and she wanted to make him listen and then kill herself. And she ended up not being able to kill herself because she ran out of bullets. She said she panicked when she entered the bedroom, and Linda immediately woke and yelled to call the police. And she insisted that this was not a planned murder. As I've been saying all along, there are 2 very differing sides to this story. And I'm looking forward to going through your opinions on this from my post about Betty on Facebook. What was going on at the time, though, was something interesting in terms of people siding with Betty, this double murderer. And I get that. Lots of us do. She became the poster child of a woman scorned, and the district attorney of San Diego County was very keen to this. So one of the first orders of business was to assign Deputy District Attorney Carrie Wells, a woman, to lead the prosecution of Betty Broderick. The DA also announced that he would not seek the death penalty, just to ensure that it did not appear that they were out for blood, and that there wasn't going to be a succession of stuffy old man lawyers picking up where Dan Broderick had left off. Betty hired a pretty successful attorney in his own right to represent her, Jack Early, known for specializing in murder cases with unusual circumstances. Betty was denied bail, so she would be sitting in county jail pending trial. And for the most part, Betty seemed to be doing okay in jail. But you know, I have this belief about situations like hers, and I kind of feel the same way about Betty as I do about Jodi Arias. I believe both of them preferred to live in prison forever rather than exist in a world where they could not have the man that they wanted as theirs anymore. For Betty, life in prison was better, easier, happier, and more tolerable than living free in a world where Dan and Linda were enjoying their happily ever after. Now that she was free of that, being in jail with them 6 feet under felt really good. She talked to her children regularly, who were living with Dan's family. She continued to interact with friends from her women's group that she had belonged to, and her attorney visited her often to get ready for the case. Betty also made the media rounds, doing what she could to shift the public perception of her, hoping to garner sympathy. But she kind of came off as somewhat nonsensical, flighty, and scattered. Betty's trial began October 22, 1990, just shy of a year after the killings. Obviously, the prosecution is calling this a premeditated murder, something that Betty thought about for a long time. And this would be driven home as the courtroom would be filled with the hundreds of hate-filled audio messages Betty left on Dan's answering machine, which included death threats. One article described the succession of calls sounding like a machine gun mercilessly firing away. Betty's attorney quickly jumped on that portrayal of his client, casting her as the victim of Dan's relentless snowstorm of paper, a litigious assault that started in 1985. That Dan Broderick was the aggressor, and his reputation as a powerful attorney could attest to that. The prosecution had a number of witnesses who testified to Betty's premeditation, with an anger that Betty made absolutely no attempts to hide. She made threats. She broke into Dan's home countless times. She had gone completely off the deep end. Dan's housekeeper heard Betty say, "I'll either make his life a living hell, or I'll kill him." Another housekeeper heard Betty say, just before Dan and Linda got married, that she was going to put 4 bullets into Dan's head, one for each of their children. Both of Dan and Betty's oldest children, daughters Kim and Lee, testified at their mother's trial. Even though Kim had been disowned by her father, which I'll talk a little bit more about later on towards the end, she painted quite a negative picture of her mother for the court in her testimony, testifying that she too heard her mother repeatedly say that she wanted Dan dead. Lee confirmed in her testimony that she heard this as well, but her testimony was much more favorable for her mother than Kim's was. She said she feared her father's temper, and she said too that she was written out of his will. But I read a conflicting report that it was only Kim. She said that her dad called her mom crazy, sick, disgusting, fat, beastly, the beast, the monster, on the rampage, on the warpath. Also pointing out that Betty really wanted to talk to her dad about the divorce, but her dad refused to speak to Betty, saying that he never wanted to see her, talk to her, or hear her voice. Betty took the stand in her own defense on October 30th. She talked about their lives together, early on in the marriage, how they struggled for years as Dan went through medical school and then law school. She began to speak through her tears as she recounted how Dan became infatuated with Linda, how he began to lie to her and their children, and how he eventually turned his back on the family by leaving the home. She discussed how Dan refused to work with her at all when it came to the legal matters involving their separation and eventual divorce, and how all of this caused her to completely collapse under the weight of the shame, humiliation, and indignity, all the way up until the day she got those 2 last letters that her visitation with her children was going to be revoked. She said, "It was just more of the same, more of the same, more of the same. Threats, manipulation. I felt like I was dying. The legal stuff was killing me. I had not slept for 2 years. I had constant headaches from biting my jaw so tight from the stress." And when it came to the aftermath of the murders, when she got to jail, Betty said, "I was able to sleep for the first time in what seemed like interminable years to me. I was happy to be locked in a dark, safe little world where nobody could get to me. And Betty's testimony struck a chord. The sympathy was there for her. Betty's testimony left an impression on the jury they could not let go of, and they hung. Two of the jurors refused to convict Betty of premeditated murder. One of the holdouts, a man named Walter Polk, said to reporters after the trial that in listening to all the testimony regarding Dan's infidelity, snobbishness, and psychological brutality, his only takeaway was, what took Betty so long? Meaning, what took her so long to put a bullet in the guy? So yeah, trial number one ended in a mistrial. Trial number two started a year later, and both the same prosecutor, Carrie Wells, and Betty's attorney, Jack Early, were back to duke it out a second time. Both of them were prepared with sharper cases, having learned from what they may have been lacking from the first. This time around, the prosecution decided to focus the jury in on the murders and not all the drama that led up to it. Wells would even refer to Betty as the executioner. She also shifted her overall demeanor to come across as more favorable to the jury. And as for Betty's attorney, well, his defense was that Betty was a battered and abused wife, and that wasn't really going to go around as easily the second time. The court refused to allow certain testimonies that had been allowed in the first trial that supported Betty having been abused, and the judge cited that other than maybe emotional abuse, there was no evidence that suggested Betty had been physically or sexually abused, which her attorney had played up in trial number one. In the second trial, Betty's attorney suggested something he had not brought up in the first, that there was a possibility that Dan may have tried to have Betty murdered. Some cab driver named Paul Taylor came forward claiming that Dan had approached him offering $500,000 to have his wife done away with. But the prosecution objected, and eventually, having found no truth to Paul Taylor's claim, banned him and any other suggestion of a hitman from the courtroom. And it was all downhill from there for Betty in trial number two. Though it would not be all that bad, as Betty would go on to be convicted of the lesser charge of second-degree murder. So it was a compromise, essentially. The Broderick family was incensed, completely appalled that the system did not see how Betty's years of constant threats finally culminated in a planned first-degree murder. Betty's attorney was somewhat pleased, though if his defense had not been stifled, he feels he could have won a manslaughter conviction. As for Betty, well, she's said to have been relieved but sad. The jury understood her fight but condemned her solution to it. She knew she wasn't going to skate, but the judge threw as much of the book at her as he could, sentencing her to the maximum of 15 years to life for second-degree murder, and he ordered the sentences to be served consecutively as opposed to concurrently, which meant Betty would be up for parole after 19 years. So Betty first went up for parole in November of 2011 when she was 64 years old. But she was denied, mainly because she wasn't remorseful, nor was she willing to admit it was wrong to shoot Linda and Dan, which doesn't surprise me. She went up for parole again in 2017 when she was 69 and was denied again. That darned remorse and admitting that it was wrong. But this time, though, the panel gave Betty the longest possible chance for parole again, which would be 15 years, so she won't be eligible until January of 2032, when she's 84. And from all that I've read, Betty seems to be content doing her program at the California Institute for Women in Corona, California. The three squares, the shower, the laundry, the phone privileges. She helps some of her fellow inmates prepare for their GED test, and has turned into somewhat of the prison socialite. She serves on boards, and she's pretty well-liked, She's looked up to and she's happy. I guess as long as Dan Broderick ceased to exist in this world, all would be well in the life of Elizabeth Ann Broderick. Today, it's been 29 and a half years since Betty murdered Dan and Linda. This November will mark the 30th anniversary of the crime. I found a blog written about this case on the 17th anniversary of Dan and Linda's murders in 2006 by blogger Laura Linger. In part, this is what she said. You know the story. Maligned ex-wife and philandering ex-husband are locked in a vicious divorce battle. Ex-husband marries the other woman. Ex-wife kills both of them. My mind has changed about Betty. At first, I felt that she was a total victim, a woman wronged by both her man and by the system where her man was clearly king. I cheered for her, murdering the philandering ex-spouse and the Tweety Bird he fucked on the down low for years before finally marrying her. After all, there was very little to like or appreciate about the victims. Dan Broderick was your garden variety sleazeball personal injury attorney who weaseled his way into a post as the president of the San Diego Bar Association. Linda Colquina was your typical skinny, vapid blonde, a fantasy girl for a midlife crisis case who was stuck with an iceberg for a wife and has a fierce desire to spend his lunch hours proving his manhood while entangled in sweat-soaked sheets after sipping cheap champagne in the airport Holiday Inn. It's the oldest story in the world. Rich, successful man in an unhappy marriage takes a mistress who grew up poor and was looking for a sugar daddy. Rich, successful man leaves the wife who helped make him so damned rich and successful. The bimbo gets the spoils. It's vastly unfair to the wronged wife. But now I'm just angry with Betty. Not for the murders, mind you. While I do believe that all killing is wrong, I will also say that there were never two people who were more hell-bent on antagonizing a woman who they claim to be crazy, repeatedly and loudly, and in their shared community, to mutual friends, to judges and therapists, to reporters, to anyone who would listen. People frightened of the tiger do not put their hands in the cage. Dan and Linda Broderick relished putting Betty Broderick through hell in the legal system. And of course, there was no one to stop them. No one was willing to stop them. Dan was the president of the Bar Association and had a lot of powerful friends. After all, it isn't every day when the judge who presides over your divorce case just so happens to be a guest at your wedding to your office tramp with whom you cheated on your first wife with for almost 3 years. I guess it's only fair to invite the judge after all. He was so helpful, looking the other way while you robbed your first wife of her marital assets so that you could legally screw her out of what was rightfully hers when you finally got around to dumping the poor sad bitch. Yet on this anniversary of her crimes, I am angry with Betty because she didn't think enough of herself and her womanhood to realize that she didn't need Dan Broderick or his money. I am angry with Betty that she didn't love her children enough to realize that they were the victims in the vicious divorce and that her behavior greatly increased their suffering, up to and including the moments where she pulled the trigger. I am angry with Betty for failing to see that the ultimate revenge against two people like Dan and Linda is to make them absolutely irrelevant in your life. You don't accomplish this with a gun. You accomplish this by refusing to play their games, by being the bigger person and knowing when to walk away, by refusing to be their pawn any longer, by realizing that she was giving them control over her life every single time she took their bait. Instead, she gave them total control over her life. She allowed it to happen. She allowed it right up until the moment when she shot and killed both of them in their marital bed. I am angry with Betty for failing to see that she had so much more options than that. that she always did, even when she felt like nothing after years of abuse at the hands of Dan and Linda, both in the legal system and out. When she felt like she was lower than low after years of their petty antics. Yet another fat and wrinkle cream ad sent anonymously to Betty by Linda Kokina. When Linda sent Betty a photo of Dan posing with Linda at some legal function and scrawled the caption, "Eat your heart out, bitch," Betty took those words to heart. And did. It didn't have to be that way. Betty was not a stupid woman, but for some reason, she was never able to see that. Ultimately, she freed herself from her tormentors, but in doing so, she just exchanged one kind of jail for another. Both were of her own making. It would have been so much better if Betty dried her eyes, realized that Dan wasn't coming back, and then focused her life and her energies on making something for herself instead of obsessing about Linda taking what used to be hers. After all, Linda Kokina was used to taking Betty's sloppy seconds. In fact, Linda's entire life with Dan Broderick was pretty much Betty's sloppy seconds, right down to Betty's wedding china, which Linda Kokina refused to allow Betty to have, even after the Broderick divorce went through, even after Linda Kokina had ordered new wedding china for her marriage to Dan. Here's a thinker. The needlepoint cover on the bed in which Dan and Linda were murdered was purchased by Betty early in her marriage to Dan. One must ask, was the blanket so beautiful that Dan Broderick simply had to keep it? Even have it on the bed you used to screw your second wife? Creepy. Not to mention, tacky. I always thought that Betty should have gone to law school. She was basically raped by the San Diego legal system and every attorney involved in it. What better way to beat them at their own game than becoming one of them? Can you imagine what Dan and Linda Broderick would have said to that? It would have eaten them both alive. There were a million things Betty could have chosen to do. Instead, she engaged in the most self-destructive behavior possible, providing both Dan and Linda with ample material with which to victimize her. Incredibly, Betty left many terrible messages on Dan Broderick's answering machine when she would call about picking up the children. It just so happened that the airy voice of Linda Kokina Broderick was on the outgoing message stating, "We cannot take your call." Betty wasn't a big enough person to let things like that go. She took their bait every single time, as Dan and Linda knew she would. That's why they did it in the first place. "This message is for fuckhead and the cunt," is a direct quote from one of Betty's expletive-filled calls. Dan left Betty for what was basically a younger version of herself. The physical similarities between Betty and Linda are shocking. Both were beautiful blonde women with svelte figures. At the time of Dan's departure from their marriage, Betty was so close to perfect as a woman could get. She was easily one of the most attractive women in La Jolla society. Understandably, when Dan dumped her for Linda, her vanity was attacked. She was humiliated and embarrassed. Did Betty resolve to maintain her unbelievable good looks? Have enough sense of self-worth to realize that it was Dan's loss? And to realize that she, Betty, could find any number of men willing to marry her? No. Instead, Betty stopped taking care of herself. She overate and gained a lot of weight. She was pudgy and puffy, and usually looked like a mess. This only intensified her envy of Linda, who now had Dan's entire wallet to spend in order to look her absolute best. Betty didn't have to do that. She didn't have to do any of it. She could have chosen to ignore them. She never had to hand them both her power. Instead, she chose to end three lives in the early morning hours of November 5th, 1989. She fired the shots that murdered Linda and Dan Broderick. But as soon as she did, Betty Broderick ceased to exist too. I don't shed any tears about Dan and Linda Broderick. The world needs fewer sleazebag attorneys, it seems. It certainly could use fewer raging alcoholics with obnoxious fellow alcoholic friends who have predilections for quoting the Blues Brothers ad nauseam, which was apparently a cherished pastime of Dan Broderick's. How original. As for Linda Coquina Broderick, she was a disgrace to every person who has ever worked hard for their money, to every woman who used their brains and their talents other than sex to get ahead in a man's world. As a paralegal myself who holds a degree from Purdue University and who graduated at the top of my class and who paid for every dime of her university education herself, I especially bristle at when Linda Coquina Broderick is referred to as a legal assistant or a paralegal. Being the office hoe and cheerleader to your partner in infidelity does not a legal assistant make. The end of Betty Broderick, however, is a crying shame. What might have been had Betty decided to rise above their pettiness and cruelty and realize that happiness is your own to make? The truly sad part is that I believe, had they lived, there is no way that Dan and Linda Broderick would still be married. Have you ever heard Dr. Phil say, if they'll do it with you, they'll do it to you? Dan would have tired of Linda as she aged, much as he tired of Betty when she started to age. There was always another bimbo glossing her lips in the ladies' room who was only too happy to take your man. Then again, Linda Coquina Broderick was supposedly sleeping with her ex-boyfriends, namely a cartoonist named Steve Kelly, by all accounts a very nice man who truly loved Linda around the time of her marriage to Dan. Linda was never the sharpest pencil in the box, with only a high school education, and her only talent seeming to be spreading her legs for other women's husbands. It would have caught up with her eventually. Nope, now Dan and Linda Broderick are rotting corpses. She buried in the wedding dress she wore only 6 months earlier. They are also martyrs because of the murders. And Betty is widely regarded as a nutcase, a pariah, a fool. I'll agree with the last one. She could have played it a million ways, found her own thing, and discovered that a man who thinks he's enough for two women is always barely enough for one. She could have gotten back at her tormentors by refusing to let them define her, manipulate her. Instead, she was their ultimate victim by making them her victims. So that was harsh, but I appreciated this blogger's perspective, and she shared some things I didn't know about. I'm still not quite sure where I land when it comes to Betty, Dan, and Linda. But there is one thing this blog did not really address when it came to all the missteps that Betty took. Mental illness. I need to reiterate that I'm not an expert, but something was really off with Betty. Experts testified in court. It was clear, well, at least it should have been clear, that Betty was a danger to herself and to others. Though we do have to consider these were different times, and it does not seem to me that anyone was alarmed enough by Betty's behavior, especially if Dan and Linda continue to taunt and provoke her. This blog said a lot about what Betty should have done differently. Betty should have thought more of herself. She should have valued her womanhood. She should have considered her children. She should have refused to be their pawn. She should not have played their game. She should not have given them control of her life. She should have seen she had more options than this. She should have made them irrelevant. She should have let her tears dry. She should have freed herself from her tormentors. She should have rose above the pettiness. She should not have let Dan define her. She should not have let them manipulate her. She should have been the bigger person. She should have walked away. But I wonder, would Betty have been capable of it? In the throes of a mental collapse, is someone going to be able to look at their options and make rational what I should and shouldn't do decisions? Betty surely had friends, relatives, lawyers, judges, experts, everyone telling her what choices would be in her best interest, but she wasn't listening, or she wouldn't listen, or she wasn't capable of listening. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I do believe Betty is happier in jail with Dan and Linda dead as opposed to free with them alive. Yes, as the blogger said, it's a different kind of prison. But for all intents and purposes, from the most recent pictures I've seen of Betty online, she looks glowingly content. So let's go over the Broderick children real quick. As far as their positions at the time of the killing and the aftermath, Kim, the eldest, testified for the prosecution against her mother. The next eldest, Lee, was the most supportive of her mother following the murders and was subsequently disinherited by Dan in his will, which he amended 1 year before he was killed. The third eldest, Rhett, he was the one who had that heartbreaking 34-minute phone call pleading with his mom to stop leaving threatening messages on his dad's answering machine. And Daniel Jr., Danny, he testified against his mother at her trial too. The children were split up after Dan was murdered. They were first sent to live with their aunt, Dan's brother's ex-wife, and one of the girls then moved in with family friends in La Jolla, and Rhett ended up living somewhere in the south, which I'm thinking means someplace down south, which could be anywhere from Tennessee to Louisiana to Georgia, Arkansas, Texas. You know, all the states that are considered southern. Lee was the most supportive of Betty. She stayed in San Diego and worked in the restaurant industry. Kim testified against Betty in both trials and did write a book entitled Betty Broderick, My Mom, in 2014. Dan Jr. is still in San Diego, and he is described as a successful San Diego businessman. He got married in 2001, and you can see their wedding portrait online. They are a lovely couple, and I don't believe he has anything to do with Betty. The Broderick children, with the exception of a visit with Oprah in 2006 by Rhett, have pretty much stayed out of the public eye. So let's go to our Facebook discussion. And I also have a few independent posts about part one and maybe a comment or so from Instagram. And everyone is all over the place. But the one thing most people tend to agree on is that murder is not the appropriate response to marital discord. Almost everyone. Okay, so Marcy K commented, obviously murder is wrong, but all the things he did were not cool. Tanya T commented that the story makes her crazy because Betty was unhinged beyond what we normally see, and there was no reason for her to go off like that. It was an overreaction. And she's saying this because it happened in her first marriage, minus the extra drama, just that he left her for someone else. Yawn, don't care. My life is so much better now, and I'm glad I'm not in prison. And Tanya and I briefly talked about Betty. And clearly there was so much more going inside her head that caused her to be incapable of coping with the breakdown of the marriage. Tanya also added that the point wasn't meant to be, and I'd never do that kind of a comment, just that Betty was way over the top and that Dan did the my wife put me through med and law school and now I want a new life thing, and Betty went too far. She could be mad and hurt, but she owed her children more than that, even herself, by trying to be better, which Tanya acknowledges is easier said than done, but that's why we evolve. DDJ commented that Betty was extra crazy, and that is not an uncommon sentiment about Betty, considering her vandalism and her obscene phone calls. It was like really out of control. Joyce L commented that she thinks that Dan could have recognized that Betty was mentally ill and handled things differently. Maybe, because hindsight is 20/20. and she doesn't want to victim blame, but also is wondering if Dan had asked a therapist for advice, if things may have ended differently. And you know, I thought the same thing. I wonder, Dan being such a smart guy, didn't he recognize that Betty was clearly losing it? Instead of taking measures to protect himself and Linda, he used what Betty was doing to attack her through the legal system. And in a sick way, maybe he was hoping she would continue to act out in the manner in which she was, so he would have more and more ammunition to use against her in court. Because he didn't want to just win, he wanted to destroy Betty in court. He's an attorney. They like to fight, and they love to win. I do understand that it's difficult to find the balance between not wanting to blame the victim, while at the same time holding him accountable for what brought Betty into his bedroom that morning to blow him and Linda away. Dory O commented, "You know, Dan was a douche, and the mistress knew he was married. They both seemed to think that they were entitled to what they wanted. So was Betty, and she played her kids against their dad," which she agrees was a low thing to do, but she does think Betty did it out of desperation. She had been a great mom up until a certain point. Marion S. said Dan was a jerk, but Betty was batshit crazy. Belky G. said she felt bad for Betty, but stopped short of excusing what she did. Lisa C. said that she finds Betty to be very scary, and if she continues to have so little control over her emotions that she hopes she never gets out. Definitely not cool to crash into a house with a car where you know your kids are inside. Also not okay to walk into somebody else's house and murder them while they sleep. If she was in prison with Betty, she would avoid her. And I'm going to agree to an extent that I don't think Betty should be let out of prison. You just can't murder two people and be back in the community again. I'm not comfortable with that. Now, if you want to argue mental illness and the like, well, then yeah, fine. She can be in a hospital. But she's not, and she never has been. She's been in a regular women's prison and appears to be doing just fine. As long as Betty still feels good and okay with killing Dan, well then, I think she needs to stay put. And any of you who think that you might be driven to do the same thing, that's fine, but you haven't. We're free to think about murder all day and night, which is basically what we do, right? But we don't act on it, and that's what sets us apart. Roy S. commented that hell hath no fury, at least that's what he's been told. Well, I'm not going to say that that isn't true in this case, because it is. But men have also been known to not take well to rejection either. The first person to pop into my head is always going to be OJ. There are plenty more. And just this past June, a month or so ago, this 23-year-old guy in Fresno, whose advances were rebuffed by a woman he met at a party, retaliated by shooting her 10-month-old baby in the head. And as far as I know, the baby named Faith survived but continues to remain hospitalized. So I would argue, health hath no fury like anyone scorned. Liberty G said that Dan was heartless and gave up on their marriage because of boredom or needed an ego boost. Betty was not innocent, using the kids against him and letting her emotions get the best of her, and she was loony. Jennifer S. said Betty would torment Dan and Linda with raving, insane, profane voicemails that the kids would hear on a daily basis. Her obsessive hate was off the charts. Betty didn't care about anything but her bitterness and seeking revenge. But she does think Dan underestimated Betty, obviously. Yeah, he was wrong. People cheat and leave their spouses every day. It sucks, but it's reality. Betty was so swept up in not being the toast of La Jolla anymore and would not let Dan and Linda win. April G. said murder is a no-no, but Dan really did Betty dirty. She did just what we all have thought about doing when scorned. Pat P. said Dan and Linda tortured Betty. she totally understands why Betty did it. Stephanie M. said that Dan and Linda tortured a crazy, unhinged person, which makes them reckless and stupid. Dan disinherited one of his daughters for siding with her mom and made stupid life choices that teenagers sometimes make, especially teenagers with selfish parents. She thinks both Dan and Betty are assholes who love to hate each other more than they love their kids. The biggest losers are the children. No one deserves to die for infidelity or general doucheness, but also no one deserves to have them as parents either. Alice and M said no matter what Dan and Linda did, they did not deserve to be murdered. She will never believe that Betty went into their house and planned to commit suicide in front of them after they talked. She does feel sorry for Betty, who likes to be thrown away for a newer model, and she did help put Dan through medical and law school. He was an attorney, so there was no way she could beat him in court. But Betty was so over the top. AJV said Betty is an unrepentant asshole. He was a shit, but she took it to psychopathic levels. Rich M feels sorry for Betty, but Dan was the one who fed the angry wolf within her. Abby S said Dan, that piece of shit husband, spurred Betty on. He sent her photos of the new wife in a bikini. Betty put him through medical and law school. Abby realizes that she's supposed to say he and his new wife didn't deserve to be murdered. Okay, yeah, but he drove Betty insane. Too bad he had to pay the ultimate price because his children, who he should have been thinking about instead of screwing someone else, miss him. Casey W. said both were incredibly selfish people. She feels bad that the life Betty built was changing, but she also can't stand when people are only capable of seeing their roles in life a specific way. For example, being only a wife and only a mother. Betty had resources and privileges that many divorcees could never dream of having, but instead of using those resources to better herself or the lives of others, she chose to kill. And she thinks Betty is exactly where she should be. Adria R. had a couple of comments, and she addressed the issue of mental health. She said Dan and Linda mentally and emotionally abused Betty. He toyed with her mentality and, if she did have mental health issues, exacerbated the problem. The fact that all of this happened in the 80s was no help. The decade of more working women, Betty having only been with Dan as a lover slash partner, their Catholic faith, her expectation of being a stay-at-home mom and his need to be the only one in the family that looked good, etc., these were all factors in her reaction. He was all she knew, and because they were married when she was 21, her brain wasn't fully developed, let alone aware of the bad things that can happen within a marriage. If this whole situation had taken place nowadays, Betty may not have gone to the lengths that she did. She felt trapped and scared out of her mind to go it alone in the world. Betty was emotionally immature and didn't have the resources we have in this day and age. She fought this battle on her own, only her growing mental instability, egged on by Dan and Linda, foul language, and desperation to not be left by the only love in her life. All of this said, there is no excuse for murdering anyone, and agrees with her sentencing. But this story is sadly a sign of the times that it happened in, and could have had a very different outcome in more recent decades. Also, Adria said that this was a difficult episode because it is unclear if there was any consideration of the fact that there was likely an underlying mental issue. Had Betty had, say, cancer, she isn't sure if Dan would have paraded Linda around as he did, or if the jury would have looked at Betty in such a way if she was on dialysis and was unmedicated. The stigma still exists today. And she thinks that there would have been a gentler approach to Betty's character had she been recognized as having a medical issue, meaning a mental one. She thinks knowledgeable judges could have sentenced her to some medical treatment or hospital stays, as well as counseling. She thinks that some of the things that happened could have been prevented if those involved know what we know now, but she isn't saying that this couldn't happen today, nor is an excuse for what Betty did. She's just saying that it's difficult to listen to based on the fact that there were clearly so many other things happening in this woman's life, body, and mind. It was hard listening to her being called crazy and Dan's actions being forgiven because he was not the first and won't be the last. And that is right. He isn't the first and he isn't the last, but he was wrong. He should have ended the marriage prior to becoming involved with Linda. He should have never gone on vacations with Betty and the kids, giving them all hope. He should have never lied to Betty by saying that there was nothing going on with Linda. Clearly there was, and this is where he, in her opinion, played with her mind and essentially abused Betty by leading her to have such a low regard for herself. This woman didn't believe in herself. Betty knew that Dan was being unfaithful but didn't want to believe it. She didn't have the strength, the finances, the mental stability, or the confidence to take this on in a more realistic and rational way. She was fighting with herself, and it was being reinforced by Dan and Linda's actions. Ann B. said that she thinks Betty snapped. However, she believes Betty is able to be rehabilitated. She needs some major dialectical behavior therapy so as to deal with her borderline personality disorder. But she also feels like Betty is a victim of Catholic Church brainwashing. She did so much, but she was not herself when all of this went down. There is always a way to manipulate the facts so they illustrate the desired narrative. She is where she should be, as there are consequences for people's choices. But no one will ever feel that pain that she felt. The opportunity she gave up to support her family and then to have something like that occur is disabling. Any problems that she was having while being incarcerated had to do with her not being treated for her mental health issues. Rebecca Jane said that their relationship was toxic and vicious. Dan gaslit her until Betty finally cracked. Betty was clearly unwell and he pushed her too far. Of course, she was terrible for what she did, but who knows how many of us would react when faced with that situation. Conchada R. said that she feels sympathy for what Betty went through before the murders. She was essentially discarded for a younger model. However, it was truly up to herself to get mentally well. She wonders if Betty's therapist ever recommended intense psychiatric treatment. Her story of being a supportive spouse through the hard times and then being left behind eventually is a very common story. She clearly had an atomic bomb level of rage. Dan, for his many faults, didn't deserve to be murdered. Despite being a victim of a violent crime, he still never comes across as anyone to sympathize with. Linda may have been a gold digger, but she also didn't deserve to be murdered. But she didn't win Dan fair and square, but he seemed to love her. The real victims are the children. Now this next name, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce it right. It's either Carrison or Saracen. Had not heard of the story prior to this, and as of part one, is really annoyed at Dan. Those were different times, and Betty was raised Catholic, which was important to her. She worked within her faith. She put him through school, and he used all of this against her. Crystal M, good old Crystal M, thinks that she'd do the same thing that Betty did. Let's hope we don't have to find out. April Green commented and said Dan got exactly what he deserved after listening to part one. What an asshole. All those years she stood by him, for him to just up and bounce on her, it's bullshit. Anna W. said Betty was seriously damaged. He must have ripped her to pieces emotionally for her to lose it like that. Something must have snapped. And Teddy G. said that both Dan and Betty were horrible people. Dan was a selfish, narcissistic asshole who used his wife's hard work to get through law and medical school, enjoyed the status as the provider for the perfect upper-class family, due largely to Betty's hard work, and then dumped her for a hot new trophy wife to replace the used model he was tired of. It's a story that's been repeated ad nauseum for ages. Betty was brainwashed by the church that want their job to be a wife and mother and to not have a career, not be her own person, but to be Mrs. So-and-so or Mommy So-and-so. Betty also clearly had some repressed mental illness that came flooding out, hence her uncontrolled rage and inability to control her behavior, even when warned by her attorney. And in the end, everyone lost. The kids lost both parents. Dan lost his life. Betty lost her freedom. And Teddy doesn't have any real feelings one way or the other about Linda, who also didn't deserve to die, except that she represented the shittiest in women. Those who use youth and beauty to avoid the hard work of standing on their own two feet, but rather to look for a sugar daddy, even if it means sleeping with someone twice your age. Antonio L. made her own post about this case and said that her head is spinning. She started listening also without having heard of Dan and Betty and felt like it was a ping pong ball going back and forth as to who carried the major fault in this tragic case. Of course, her conclusion by the end of part one is all three of them sucked, Dan, Betty, and Linda. And yep, I tend to agree. The conversation that we described between Betty and her son on the phone was heartbreaking. Those kids deserve better than that. And as for the grandparents here in the case, I did not pick up on any information regarding them. I believe Dan's parents stayed back in Pennsylvania and Betty's in New York, and it just sounds like they visited on occasions. Temre I, who I hope I said that correctly too, made her own post about this, and it was quite personal, and I want to thank you for sharing. She said that she is Betty Broderick, up until the point she lost her effing mind. Her ex had an affair, kept denying it, and was telling her she was crazy. It was a huge point of contention between them until he finally walked out and married someone else immediately. And thank goodness she kept her shit together. Yes, thank goodness. Lynn Marie B. said this all sounds like a great deal of narcissistic gaslighting on Dan's part. He had the money and the power, and he used it to drive Betty to insanity. Most people in those situations end up like Betty, broke and without a soul. However, they don't kill anyone, except maybe themselves. Rebecca W. said that while she doesn't agree with what Betty did, she always had a certain degree of compassion for her. Dan was so cruel, and this case has fascinated her ever since she read about it. And Rebecca was ironically on her way to her divorce hearing. Well, Rebecca, you seem to be in good spirits about it, unlike angry Betty. So I hope all goes smoothly for you and your children if you have any. Another Rebecca, Rebecca M., said it's easy to have sympathy for Betty's situation, but she clearly had issues. She's certain that Betty was tough to live with and was a little on the crazy side. And I kind of touched on that myself, and I agree that I think that she was really difficult at home and was making Dan more and more distant because of it. That said, Betty's husband was an asshole. Her story is the story of so many women. She can see how that kind of anger and frustration can build up, and if you're mentally unstable, boom. Sarah W. said that this kind of behavior, gaslighting, is too common. She has never been married, but she has certainly had experiences with men that involve them trying to make her feel and look insane when she actually knew precisely what was going on. They just have a way of making you doubt yourself. It's enough to drive anyone crazy. Unfortunately, Betty was someone who wasn't stable enough to find a way to move on. And lastly, over at Instagram, Holly P. said that she has many mixed feelings about this story, and lots of us do, myself included. No one deserved to die, yet Dan was such a selfish asshole, and that woman he hooked up with was no better. On the other hand, Betty made a huge mistake putting all her energy into acting on that anger that she rightfully felt. She should have just cut ties and let Dan be that new chick's problem, because eventually that's how it was going to go. The moment Linda stopped stroking Dan's ego, he'd be on to the next and she'd be out in the cold, just like Betty. But at most, Dan needed a foot planted up his tail, and Linda was just young and dumb. Never get involved with a married person. If they'll do it with you, they'll do it to you. It sounds like Dan was a master at gaslighting, and it's all so sad. I want to thank everyone for sharing all of your thoughts and personal experiences with us on social media. I don't know about you guys, but I learned a lot as we're nearing the end of this. I also noticed that not too many men had all that much to say in the comment section here. I think that there may have been two. That might probably be for the best, I suppose. So, I want to get this part two out to you soon, hopefully today. This is Wednesday. I'm finally wrapping this up, and I'm so ready to move on to the next case. So, I will end this now without all the extra stuff I usually include in the end. You all heard it in part one. Just come back to Facebook or Instagram when you're done with this and let me know what you think about that blog, and if you think that Betty should ever be free. And as for her children, I shared what I could find from all that I could see. At least half of them are doing all right despite everything. And that's all we can hope for. That the plan that Dan and Betty originally had together to raise good, decent members of society was able to come to fruition through their good work. That's probably the best thing that they could do in their father's memory. If nothing else, they could be the four things that Dan and Betty actually did right. Thank you for listening. Until next time, sweet dreams.